Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire Talk Radio. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today we'll be taking time to speak with Mark Goldwine, the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and Concord's Policy Director, Josh Gordon. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Congressional Budget Office has considered tax cuts, spending increases, and changes in economic conditions since its budget projections last June, and has decided to add $1.58 trillion in expected annual deficits between now and 2027. That is in addition to the $10.1 trillion it forecast in deficits for 2017 to 2027 last year, which means the new total amounts to about $11.7 trillion in annual deficits over the next decade. Concern arose over funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, when the Trump administration proposed to rescind $15 billion in previously approved spending from prior years because that rescission's package seemingly reduced funding for CHIP by $7 billion. However, the Congressional Budget Office concluded that the rescission of funds that can no longer be spent or were no longer needed for certain programs would not result in any children losing their insurance. Regardless, the rescissions package is getting pushback from members of Congress for a whole host of other reasons, especially in the closely divided Senate. There has been recent pushback as well in the Senate by some members with regard to the recently passed tax law and whether the individual tax cuts, which were designed to sunset in a few years, should be made permanent. To limit the cost of last year's tax code overhaul to $1.5 trillion, which was required under the budget resolution at the time, Congress made the individual tax cuts temporary. Some members, like Senator Jeff Flake, are calling for spending offsets if such tax cuts are indeed made permanent. In fact, Flake labeled the political maneuver of making the tax cuts temporary to abide by budget rules and then making them permanent once Congress was no longer bound by such rules an act of bad faith. Here is how little interest Congress has in proposing a budget resolution for fiscal year 2019. At the one hearing where House members could weigh in on their budget priorities in front of the Budget Committee, of all the members of the House of Representatives, only one showed up. House Budget Chairman Steve Womack had this to say, and quote, "I think it's a manifestation of the fact that the process is severely broken and not entirely useful. Therefore, there's a lack of respect for the process now," end quote. House Budget Chairman Womack and Senate Budget Chairman Michael Enzi have agreed to, in quote, deem the discretionary spending levels for fiscal year 2019 as allowed by the bipartisan budget agreement passed in 2018. President Trump put forth a plan to try and help lower prescription drug costs, but he left out one of the ideas on which he campaigned, allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. His overall plan will attempt to reduce high-list drug prices and the out-of-pocket costs of patients by spurring generic drug production, reducing intellectual property theft, removing government barriers that the administration believes hinder competition and price negotiation, pushing for specific reforms in Medicaid and Medicare Parts B and D, and discouraging price controls abroad. The administration actually took aim at other governments with national health care systems that set lower drug prices for their citizens. The administration believes those nations are effectively unjustly benefiting from research and development that takes place in the U.S. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the program by Mark Goldwine and Bob Bixby as we discuss Budgeting for the Next Generation, a look at how the federal budget affects children. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Joining the program today is Bob Bixby and Mark Goldwine. Bob, of course, is Concord's executive director. Mark is the senior vice president and senior policy director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, where he conducts research on a wide variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget. In 2010, he served as the associate director of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. In 2011, he was a senior budget analyst on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. He also teaches economics at the University of California, D.C. and at Johns Hopkins University. And in 2011, Mark was featured in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for law and policy. Welcome to Facing the Future, Mark and Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be back.
So, Mark, I wanted to start with a broader look here and get your take overall on the federal budget and its our national priorities. You know, what does our level of spending and the areas in which we spend, what's that indicate for us as a nation in terms of what our priorities are?
Well, I think if you look at current federal spending, you'd have to come up with two conclusions. One is that we are spending far more than we are bringing in tax revenue. And the second is that we are spending far more on the elderly than on anyone else, particularly on children. And you add those two conclusions together, that we're spending very little and investing on our children, and we're borrowing, which means that we're burdening our children with substantially more debt. You get a budget that's very generationally focused toward those that are older and towards the past at the expense of younger and future generations.
And Mark, you mentioned investing in children. In fact, you and CRFB are working on a series called Budgeting for the Next Generation, and it concerns children and the federal budget and their future. What prompted that study for you and the organization? And can you give sort of a 30,000-foot summary or overview of it and your initial findings?
I think something really encouraging we've seen in recent American politics is a new level of activism. Among younger Americans, among children and teenagers who generally aren't very involved in the political process. But too few of them understand the degree to which they're really getting shortchanged through the budget. I mean, we have an unsustainable federal debt, which means that every dollar of new borrowing we do today is effectively a dollar that's going to have to be paid back in some form tomorrow. I mean, we are burdening our children with a huge debt. A child born today is going to face $45,000 of debt off the bat.
Wow.
And yet we're doing very little to invest in them, to invest in their productivity, in their nutrition, in their growth.
And so you mentioned a very specific number, $45,000 in debt that they're going to bear right off the bat. What are you basing that number off of?
That's just their share of the current $15 trillion national debt. It's not as if we have to get the federal debt down to zero, so it's not as if they have to pay all that back. But every dollar of debt the federal government owes is a dollar that we've got to pay interest payments on. And that means that we're going to be spending more surfacing our past irresponsibility over time than our future investments.
And Mark, you mentioned, you know, that we're not investing as much as probably we should in children. What share of the federal budget is dedicated to programs right now that invests in future generations?
Right. So, as you mentioned, we've launched this new series, Budgeting for the Next Generation, and in large part, we've been assisted by the great work that's been done at the Urban Institute through their KidShare project. And if you look at their data and others, you find that basically, however you cut it, we spend about one out of every $10 in the budget on children. Hmm. We spend about one out of every $10 in tax breaks on children. And even that includes money that we're effectively spending for parents on their kids. So that's not very much when you consider that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid combine to make up more than half of the budget, and most of their money is going to the elderly.
Hmm. So you started to dive in there a little bit on the proportion of what we spend and where. Can you name some of the programs specifically that are used to invest in generations and future generations, and then maybe what some of the long-term trends are in relation to those programs?
Right. So what's interesting, what the KidShare folks and others have found is that most of the spending that we do on children is actually programs that also go to adults. So, for example, the single biggest spending program towards children is the Medicaid program. And if you add Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, a few of those other programs that go broadly, because children actually have a very high poverty rate relative to the population, they get a very high share of the benefit. But we also spend on a large number of programs that are dedicated solely or largely towards children. For example, education, both Title I that goes towards lower income and towards special needs and things like Head Start. Hmm. As another example, we have child nutrition programs, including school lunch subsidies, et cetera. As another example, we have temporary aid to needy families, which really is mainly a welfare benefit for parents of young children. So we do have a large number of programs that go to children. On the tax side, we also have the child tax credit. The problem is when you add all these up, they're not very much money relative to what we're spending on everything else. And their future is much more uncertain in some sense than what we're spending on other types of programs.
And Mark, I've always viewed spending in the budget sort of going into two different camps. You've got primarily discretionary spending and mandatory spending. A lot of the programs you talked about that feed into supporting our elderly population, our retirees, like Medicare and Social Security, have a dedicated funding source and are part of mandatory spending. Where do some of these programs that invest in children, where do they fall in terms of what type of spending?
So this is really interesting. This is going to be a big focus of our Budgeting for the Next Generation project, which is the budget process really is skewed towards adults and the elderly. As you mentioned, Social Security and Medicare, they are mandatory in the sense that they will pay effectively as much money as needed to ensure their beneficiaries get their benefits. And they also have a dedicated funding source. Programs like education, K-12 education, are the other extreme. This money is appropriated every year on a discretionary basis. It is no dedicated funding source. And so whereas Social Security and Medicare are completely on autopilot, education has to be reauthorized every year over and over again. Now, there's a lot of programs that are somewhere in between. For example, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, that's a mandatory program, but it has to be reauthorized on a regular basis, sometimes 5 years, sometimes more, and it has a capped dollar allotment. That's similar for other programs like food stamps as well.
And how does that compare to programs like Social Security and Medicare? Do they have a capped allotment?
Social Security and Medicare are effectively unlimited entitlements. I say effectively because they do have one limit. They have trust funds. But as long as their trust funds have money in them, they can spend as much as they need to basically provide the benefits they've promised. Programs like CHIP and food stamps, programs like CHIP, I should say, and TANF are budgeted. There's a cap on how much they can spend. Programs like food stamps are unlimited entitlements like Social Security and Medicare in terms of how much they can spend annually, but they need to be reauthorized every few years. So the programs really are all over the place. But if you look at them holistically, what you see is that programs for children tend to be 1 year, 5 years, and tend to be more capped and tend to grow with inflation, sometimes a bit faster, sometimes a bit slower. Whereas programs for adults and the elderly especially tend to be more on the entitlement side. They tend to be uncapped, and they tend to be permanent.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Mark Goldwine and Bob Bixby. It seems like if a lot of the funding for these programs is in the discretionary side of the budget, that it puts a lot of them at risk. And then we saw recent legislation with the president putting forth a rescissions package that focused a little bit on CHIP. Why might there be a reluctance in making reforms or changes in Social Security and Medicare versus almost keeping things like CHIP and other programs constantly on potentially the chopping block?
Well, I think we overstate a little if we pretend that programs for children are unpopular. And the truth is there aren't very many spending cuts in government, either for the elderly or for the children. Difference is the starting point. The starting presumption for Social Security and Medicare is basically that they're going to grow at give or take 8% a year. So any time that we have a proposal that grows them at 7% a year, that's considered a cut. On the other hand, the starting presumption for a lot of these education programs is effectively zero nominal growth. So if we give them just an inflation adjustment year by year, that's considered an increase. Right? If you think about an inequity, when giving children 2% at inflation is considered an increase, but giving the elderly 7% is considered a cut. That's a large reason we end up in the situation we're in, where the elderly programs continue to grow rapidly as a share of the budget, whereas children programs really peaked in 2010 and have been declining ever since.
And I've been dominating the conversation, Bob. I apologize. I think it's a good time to shift over to you and see if you might have any questions for Mark at this point.
No, that's fine, Chase. You're on a roll. Mark, we've been talking mostly on the spending side. I want to bring in the revenue side a little bit here. Last year, of course, the big legislative action was a major tax bill, which is projected to increase the deficits over the next 10 years and the debt. What's the generational impact of that legislation?
Right. So we desperately needed tax reform. Let me start by saying that. Our corporate rate was the highest in the developed world. Our individual code was a mess. But the tax reform they did, was a huge tax cut. And the generational impact of that tax cut by itself is going to skew towards hurting children. But when we look at the specifics, the situation is even worse, because the biggest tax cuts really were on the corporate side. And while, again, we needed those lower corporate rates, big immediate corporate tax cuts mostly end up in the hands of shareholders. Guess who owns most of the money? People that are older, people that have time to save and accumulate assets. So, for example, the Tax Policy Center looked at this, and they looked at higher earners. Say, I'll give you the example of folks making between $200,000 and $500,000 a year. If you made in that range and you were an adult, you got about a 2% of income tax cut. If you made that around that age and you were above age 65, you got about a 3% of income tax cut. So the tax cuts themselves were skewed toward asset holders, which means they were really skewed more towards the elderly. On the other hand, when you cut taxes in a situation where debt is already growing unsustainably, you almost by definition have doomed future generations to either face a tax increase of at least an equal amount or a spending cut of at least equal amount. And assuming that cut doesn't or increase doesn't happen in the next year or next 2 years, by definition, it's going to accrue more towards future and younger generations and less towards older generations. I can't imagine us coming back in 2 years and saying, well, the elderly got a big tax cut, so we're going to slash their Social Security. No, we're going to come back in a few years and we're going to say, well, the debt is out of control. So we need to make some changes. We need to do those adjustments gradually. And unfortunately, the reality is that means the children are going to face higher tax rates and get lower benefits relative to the folks that actually benefit from these tax cuts. There's a huge generational inequity already in the budget, and the tax cuts just exacerbated it.
One of the arguments for the tax cut, of course, was that it would stimulate economic growth and that that would be good for the long term. And by definition, then people that support the tax cut would say, well, maybe there'll be a deficit hit in the short term. There'll be a better growth in the long term. What's your analysis of that?
Well, the tax cuts are likely to stimulate economic growth in the near term and may even continue to boost the economy modestly over the medium term. But the issue is this. Lower tax rates are good for the economy, but higher debt is bad for the economy. And debt just takes longer to phase in. And so basically every analysis has shown is that over time, the benefits of these tax cuts are going to wane, especially as pieces expire. But the cost of the higher debt is going to grow. So the next 2 years, yes, we're going to get an economic boost. The next 5 to 10 years, very likely the economy will be a little bit larger than it otherwise would have been. But if we start looking 15, 20, 30 years down the road, I think what we're going to find is that this higher debt is going to swamp the benefits of the lower tax rates.
It's not a case of the tax cuts paying for themselves.
Well, for a tax cut to pay for itself, you would basically need $6 of growth for every $1 of tax cuts.
Ain't going to happen. Right?
We'd be lucky if we get 25 cents of growth for every dollar of tax cuts here.
Wow.
One of the consequences of higher debt that directly translates into the budget is the cost of interest payments on the debt. And one of the things that you noted in this paper on the children's budget is that I thought was very interesting is that the amount of interest that we pay on the debt is almost right now as much as everything that's spent on children's programs, and within a couple of years, a very short time, the amount of interest on the debt with all the higher deficits projected in debt and interest rates going up will easily surpass everything we spend on children probably by 2020 or so.
That's right. We're in only a few years, we'll be spending more servicing our past debt than we will investing in our future.
That really is worth.
It's pretty crazy
driving
if you think
home.
About it.
I mean, that it is. It's talk about budgetary priorities.
I mean, would you run a business that way? Would you run a business where you're spending more money servicing your debt than you were investing in the future? I don't think so. And when you consider that this isn't a business, this is our kids and our grandkids that we're talking about. It's even more shameful. But interest is the fastest growing part of the budget. We expect it's going to pass children's spending in just a few years. It's going to increase. It's going to pass Medicaid spending in the early 2020s, defense spending in the mid 2020s, all of non-defense discretionary in the late 2020s. It really is going to swamp everything else.
And Mark, that prompts a couple questions for me. One, it sounds like we are, in essence, crowding out investing in future generations from the rest of the budget with the growth of mandatory spending programs and interest on the debt. Now, how do we start to reverse that trend or at least stabilize it so it doesn't continue?
The sad reality of our fiscal situation is, in my view, it's too late for us to reverse this trend. We've made too many commitments to the elderly, but we could slow it down at a pretty rapid pace. We could slow it down so we are, you know, our debt is already owed, so we have to pay interest. We have to pay our debtors, and we're nowhere near a balanced budget. But we can slow this down in a few ways. First of all, we need to get Social Security and Medicare under control so that we're putting those resources towards the best health care and towards the Social Security beneficiaries that need it most, rather than just spending the increasing shares of the budget indefinitely wherever it should be. So that's number one. We need to get entitlement reform. Number two, we absolutely need more tax revenue. The tax bill that we just passed did some good things, but by and large, it was a step in the wrong direction. So tax reform round two needs to be about fixing tax reform round one. That means closing some of the loopholes it created, means cutting the tax breaks we were unwilling to cut. And if that's not enough, it means raising some of the tax rates back up or coming with another revenue source. And number three, we need to fix the budget process so children are less deprioritized, less than the elderly. I'm not so naive to think that we can flip this and turn mandatory programs into annual appropriations and make education permanent entitlement. But we need to even the playing field to some degree. And we could do that by more multi-year budgeting when it comes to investment in children, and more multi-year budgeting when it comes to entitlements in the elderly. For children, that would be a longer time horizon, but for Social Security and Medicare, that would be a shorter time horizon. That would mean actually reviewing these programs every few years rather than just waiting for some kind of trust fund crisis.
And Mark, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I wish we had another half hour to an hour to continue talking about all these incredibly important issues. But if you were to make a plea to Congress on why it's important to invest in future generations as sort of a prompt to engage in some of these reforms, what would you say?
If you ran for Congress just to figure out what to do with the next election, you're not going to be there for long. People are elected to figure out, to solve our long-term problems, to figure out how to fix the next generation. And right now, we're in danger of leaving the next generation a worse world than the one that we inherited. And the budget process skews us away from investing in our children, while our budget decisions are leaving our children with a huge burden of debt. That's exactly backwards.
And you know what I'd tell them, Chase?
What, Bob?
I'd tell them, listen to Mark.
Maybe we all should listen to Mark. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Mark Goldwine, and Bob Bixby discuss how the federal budget impacts future generations. Up next, Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon will be joining me to discuss the Trump administration's recent proposal to help reduce prescription drug costs. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I have the pleasure of welcoming back Concord's Policy Director, Josh Gordon. Josh directs the Concord Coalition's research on the federal budget, healthcare policy, and tax policy. He has a PhD in political science from the University of Florida, and he has been with Concord since 2001. Josh was on the show a couple weeks ago to talk healthcare, and I'm happy to have him back. Thanks for taking the time to offer your insights once again, Josh.
My pleasure to be here, Chase.
So today I wanted to talk a little bit more about healthcare, especially the recent proposal by the Trump administration that's aimed at helping reduce prescription drug costs and out-of-pocket expenses for patients. But before we drill down into the specifics of that proposal, can you give me a quick overview of where we are as a nation in terms of how much we spend on prescription drugs, how that relates to the federal budget, and so on?
Well, as you know, we spend a lot of money on healthcare in general. Mm-hmm. About 18% of our economy is spent on some form of healthcare good or service. And the prescription drug spending makes up about 10% of that total spending, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is many, many hundreds of billions of dollars. And more importantly, really, for the fiscal future, is that prescription drug spending is really the fastest growing aspect of our healthcare spending if you look at projections over the next 10 years. And I think that's why there was a fair amount of attention to prescription drug spending on the campaign trail. And certainly President Trump had campaign promises related to it. And this is really the first effort for the administration to outline what they're going to attempt to do to restrain the growth of prescription drug costs.
And what's your take on the administration's proposal and its potential effectiveness at constraining that cost growth?
I think the big thing to say about this proposal is that it's a big question mark. I think there's a lot that we don't really know. There's a lot that's going to take a while to see how it plays out. And I think one of the things that I've seen a lot of analysts say about this plan is that it is fairly uncertain about how effective parts will be. And actually, in the plan itself, there were 136 question marks, which I think indicates that there's still a lot to be decided, a lot of choices to make. And this is really, I would think, more accurately thought of as kicking off a discussion over what to do about prescription drug prices and not much about what will be immediately done to lower the growth of those prescription drug costs.
And when you said there was over 130, was it, question marks in the proposals, is that just because they didn't know what each proposal would actually do, or what does that mean?
Yeah, I think it's partially they're not quite sure what they want to do or what these things will do. And a lot of it, a lot of the plan is premised on the fact that the HHS secretary, acting really as the chief person in charge of Medicare and Medicaid, has a fair amount of discretionary power to experiment with how to bring about at least some changes in how Medicare and Medicaid pay for prescription drugs, with the hope that that somehow filters down to all of us who get our health insurance and health care coverage from Medicare, Medicaid, and other forms of health insurance. So he has that power, and I think the question is to what extent he can use it, where is it most effective for him to use it, where Congress needs to be involved, and how that will interact with the rest of the healthcare system. And all of those things are really a lot of open questions. But I do think it's good that they're talking about it. I think there is a bit of a problem that they maybe have overpromised both before the release of this plan and in kind of the rhetoric surrounding this plan in terms of what it will do in any kind of short-term sense.
And you almost, I think you took the words right out of my mouth in terms of the next question I had was, how much of this plan can be done just through the Trump administration and the executive branch versus what will require action by Congress? And I guess a follow-up to that would be, are these proposals sort of in the realm of what's been discussed before, or are a lot of these, because there's so many questions, new endeavors?
Well, let me take that part first. I think a lot of the things that were discussed have been discussed before, which in a way is good because there's actually a fair amount of bipartisan support for a fair amount of these things. The bad part about that, and this also goes to whether we need Congress to act, is that most experts think the major aspects driving the price of drugs
are left untouched by this plan and really would require Congress to think differently about how to have prescription drug monopolies through the patent system, how to have Medicare and Medicaid pay for prescription drugs. And that would really just involve a much different view, and that was not evident in this plan, and really would require Congress to get involved to implement and enact.
And you mentioned that this proposal leaves many of the drivers of cost and prescription drugs untouched. What are some of those drivers? How does this sort of miss the mark there?
I mean, the big driver is that we have private drug companies develop these drugs, and then Medicare basically agrees to pay whatever the drug companies ask for these drugs. And all Medicare asks in return is that these drugs don't kill people, that they're safe. Medicare doesn't ask that these drugs are effective. And so that's kind of a fundamental problem where you have an open-ended budget, you have a private company that wants to maximize revenue, and you don't have the ability to really say no. There's not always a lot of competition because of the patent protection that new drugs and new technologies get in general.
And you brought up Medicare, which then brings me to one of the other questions I had about an issue that the president actually campaigned on and it has been popular in Democratic circles, is allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. And this proposal doesn't even go down that road. Now, were you surprised that that was left out?
I wasn't really surprised, because when you look at this generic promise that politicians really have made for a fair amount of time, that if just Medicare would negotiate prices with these drug companies, we could get drug costs down. But the Congressional Budget Office and almost every expert that's looked at it have really said that that kind of misses the mark, that just having Medicare negotiate prices, it isn't going to do very much if Medicare also doesn't have the power to actually not buy a specific drug, because you have to have the threat that if you don't accept our price, we will not allow you to sell your drugs to Medicare patients. Then it's kind of an empty threat, and then you have very little market power to drive down prices. And that's where these proposals have always fallen short. Even President Trump's campaign promises were about Medicare negotiating prices, but not about Medicare creating a drug formulary where if you didn't accept our price that Medicare negotiates, we won't let you sell your drug to Medicare patients. I think that's the big missing piece that that politicians sometimes skip over.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Josh Gordon, Concord's policy director. And Josh, you hit on several points that make me feel like we need broader reforms throughout Medicare as opposed to sort of targeted or piecemeal proposals, which it sort of seems like this particular proposal might be going down that path. How do we get to a point in Congress where we can have those broader Medicare reforms so that you can have an effective system, a more effective system?
Well, with prescription drugs specifically, I think it's pretty clear the demand by constituents and the American public for action on this is going to just keep increasing. I think this is one of those issues that crosses party lines, state lines, economic status, and age. And people are upset about how expensive prescription drugs are. They're going to continue to be upset about that as prescription drug spending drives overall healthcare spending higher, taking more money out of our pockets. And so I do think this is one of those areas where there will be pretty strong demand for congressional action. Now, as we've seen in a partisan atmosphere, even policies that have strong demand from constituents don't always get considered. But I do think this is really the beginning of going down the path of Congress eventually doing something, because you have a Republican administration with actually drug company, former drug company representatives running HHS and other and the FDA, And yet they seem to be aligned with action towards limiting prescription drug costs. And I think we will eventually get there. I don't want to be all negative about this plan. I think there were some interesting small measures in here that are worth talking about. One thing people might not realize is that right now there are limits on what pharmacists are allowed to tell you in terms of whether there are cheaper alternatives when you go to pick up your prescription. And one of the things this calls on is for those so-called gag rules to be eliminated. Hmm. And this is really kind of like a simple intuitive step that I think people would be pretty surprised we don't already allow. But
right.
It's a no-brainer that a pharmacist should be able to suggest a cheaper alternative. So that was one of those little parts of this that I thought was really interesting and seems like a good way forward.
What are, you mentioned that there were a few. You want to talk through a couple of the others that you thought might be good first steps? As you said, I agree with you. I think this is the beginning of a conversation that needs to happen in our country.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing, and Chase, you might like this because you're a lawyer, that there is also a suggestion that maybe drug companies in their television advertisements need to include the list price of the drug as part of that advertisement, like they do now, you know, side effects and that kind
of
thing.
Right.
If they include the price as well, one, that would have really, I think, a mind-blowing impact on people to some degree, because I'm not sure people realize how expensive these drugs really are.
Yeah.
Because a lot of us have third-party insurance. There is a suggestion that this might run afoul of the First Amendment, although I've also read some pretty compelling legal cases why that wouldn't be the case. So that's one of like the really interesting thought pieces that they brought to the table, which I'm intrigued by.
And the lawyer in me just imagines that they're going to merely list that price, you know, in the incredibly fine print at the bottom of the commercial. So I think you'd have to craft it in such a way that you can avoid that happening. If this is the beginning of a conversation, and it's a conversation that will certainly need bipartisan support, and I hope that happens. What are some of the potential reforms that you could see coming into play here that may already have some bipartisan support in Congress?
Well, it seems like there is a fair amount of support for having generic drug manufacturers have an easier time getting their products to market. One of the actual big successes over the last 10 or so years in our healthcare markets in general is that we really do have a fairly high rate of generic drug adoption when those generic drugs are available. And that's led to actually having the cost of drug spending in general grow even more slowly than it would have otherwise. Now it's growing very fast, but it would have been even faster had we not adopted some nudges along the way to get people to adopt generic drugs more rapidly. And I think there's still a ways to go on having increased competition with generic drugs. So I think that's something that might have some bipartisan support. And then there's always my favorite thing, which maybe I would call this having no partisan support, even though it's something, again, that I think is very intuitive, is that we really do need to start researching which drugs work better than others. And I think this is a fundamental task that we will have as we try and figure out how to squeeze healthcare into the budget over the long term. We need to start learning what things work better than others and what things are more cost effective. And that's something we're not allowed to do now, and we really need to take seriously and do more of, because I think we all want to take effective prescription drugs. We all want healthcare procedures that work well for us. And I think we'd all be more comfortable if we knew our doctors and our pharmacists had the right information when they go to perform that surgery or prescribe that specific drug. So that's kind of what I would look for as the most hopeful thing we could do out there to make more sense about our healthcare spending.
And those sound like really good starting points for a national conversation or dialogue on this particular issue. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I've been talking with Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon, and unfortunately, our conversation has to come to an end. We've been talking about the Trump administration's recent proposal to reduce prescription drug prices. Josh, thank you again for joining the show.
My pleasure.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Expressions of concern about the deficit are not always what they seem. Almost every politician at the national level has expressed some concern at one point or another about the federal government's budget deficits. But one clear takeaway from the past 25 years is that those concerns are often situational and quickly abandoned as soon as they become politically inconvenient. Most legislation has some fiscal impact, either in cutting taxes or increasing spending. Often, budgetary concerns expressed by a bill's opponents are sincere. But sometimes, critics of the underlying policy will use its effect on the deficit merely as a convenient weapon against it. Their concerns then magically dissipate as soon as it comes time to consider deficit finance proposals that they support. Many Republicans, for example, expressed deep concern over budget deficits during the presidencies of Democrats Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. But when a Republican president took office, many in the GOP had a change of heart and supported tax cuts, a new Medicare prescription drug benefit, and two military engagements, all deficit financed. Today, many Republicans who were fierce fiscal hawks under President Obama passed large tax cuts without offsets, even though the economic case for it was far weaker than when either Presidents Obama or George W. Bush took office. Republicans are not the only culprits, however. Democrats, many of which criticized the deficit impacts of large tax cuts or spending policies under President Bush, had no qualms about extending several of those same tax cuts and spending policies under a Democratic president. Many Democrats also now advocate for massive expansion of entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare without realistic plans to pay for them. Then, of course, we had the 2018 bipartisan budget deal, where both parties agreed to significantly increase discretionary spending levels. The Trump administration has also proposed a $15 billion rescissions package to take back spending authority from past spending bills. But it's not reducing actual committed spending, and it functions as little more than a smokescreen because it does nothing to reduce growing budget deficits or exhibit fiscal responsibility. Politicians should be judged by their actions, not their words. When one talks like a deficit hawk only to turn around and support expensive legislation that adds to our growing national debt, the only logical conclusion is that their past budgetary concerns weren't what they appeared to be. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.